Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I have today a wonderful interview with Esther M. Sternberg, MD. Esther Sternberg received her MD and rheumatology training at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and was on the faculty at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, before joining the National Institutes of Health in 1986. She is currently chief of the section on neuroendocrine immunology and behavior at the National Institute of Mental Health. Dr. Sternberg is also director of the Integrative Neural Immune Program at National Institute of Mental Health, National Institute of Health, and co-chair of the NIH Intramural Program on Research and Women's Health. This week's topic is how your state of mind, including your stress level, affects your immune system, your state of health, and maybe even your biological age. We're talking with Dr. Esther Sternberg, a physician, a medical researcher, and the author of two books, The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions, and Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. Dr. Sternberg, those are some interesting titles, and I like the idea that you are focusing on the science of healing. Please tell us a little bit about your second book, which will be coming out in December, I believe. No, yeah. It's already out.
Just came out in May.
Your second book, which just came out in May. I'm intrigued by the concept of healing spaces because as a physician, I round at the hospitals and I find that those spaces are among the most jangly, disturbing, and least healing spaces that I have ever seen.
Well, that's actually, it's one of the chapters is about exactly that, hospitals and well-being. But maybe the best way to approach this is to tell you how I got into this subject.
Please.
I am, as you mentioned, a physician and a medical researcher. I started out in family practice, and then I trained as a rheumatologist, went back and took care of arthritis patients, and then almost serendipitously fell into a research career by seeing a single patient who had been treated with, back then in 1980, what was an experimental drug for a very rare form of epilepsy. And he developed an autoimmune scarring inflammatory disease. And that one patient and his pain and suffering really launched me into trying to figure out what this brain-immune connection was all about. And it led me in sort of very interesting circuitous routes, eventually discovering that there indeed was a connection between the brain's hormonal stress response and susceptibility to arthritis. And in a strain of rats that was being used by immunologists and rheumatologists to study arthritis. And when you can actually prove to the scientific community that the part of the brain and the brain's stress hormone, the part of the brain that controls stress and the brain's stress hormone is out of balance and part of the reason that these rats develop arthritis, then it's hard to dismiss the notions that are present in the popular culture for thousands of years in human patients that stress can make you sick. And the flip side, that perhaps believing and salubrious activities and even space and place around you can help to make you well.
When you talk about the science that demonstrated that, let's go into some detail there and drill down to that science, what you studied, and how it proved that to the medical community.
Well, what happened was, with my background in family practice, I actually made a house call on these rats at midnight, if you will. When the student who was working for me injecting this experimental drug, which I had found in tissue culture was beneficial to the immune system. I found that it actually could suppress inflammation. So we said, great, we have the next new anti-arthritis drug. And I started this series of experiments where we were testing the drug in rats that had been exposed to bits and pieces of streptococcal bacteria. In these particular rats, if they were exposed to strep cell walls, they would get something that looked like human rheumatoid arthritis. So we had the rats that get arthritis and their cousins, very closely matched cousins, that didn't get arthritis when they were exposed to the same bits and pieces of bacteria, and gave them all the same drug. And lo and behold, at midnight, I got a call from the student who was injecting the second dose of the drugs, and he said, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I've done something terribly wrong. All the rats are dying. And I said, well, this is a terrible thing. We certainly weren't expecting that. We were expecting to cure these rats. So I drove into the lab, and in fact, it wasn't all the rats. It was only the rats that were supposed to be fine, the control rats, the rats that had no tendency to arthritis. And they were the ones that were dying in something that looked like septic shock. They reminded me, when I saw what was happening, of patients that I had taken care of in the emergency room who had septic shock. And the only way I could explain this phenomenon, which was exactly the opposite of what we had expected, is I knew something about that drug that we were testing, which, by the way, never made it to the market. You should be
just parenthetically
pleased to know. So I knew something about that drug, and that is that it blocked the brain's stress response. It was a drug that had been originally developed as an antihypertensive, and it blocked the brain's stress response. And I had seen some very early work at that time by Candace Pert, who had shown that there were interleukin-1 receptors around the brain's stress center, the hypothalamus. And I thought, well, maybe what's happening when these rats are exposed to strep cell walls is they're getting effectively septic or an inflammatory condition. And maybe what's happening is the brain stress response, which ultimately releases cortisol, is there for a reason. It's there to tune down the immune system to stop it from going out of control. And if you block it, maybe what's happening is you're blocking the body's own way of preventing that massive release of inflammatory and immune molecules that occurs during sepsis. And that's why these rats were dying. Whereas their cousins that develop arthritis were perfectly fine. They really couldn't care less. And I thought maybe what happened with those rats is they developed some kind of backup mechanism, some kind of system where they were able to get through this because they didn't rely on the brain's stress response. So we effectively shifted from experiments in which we were testing this new potential anti-inflammatory drug, which turned out to be the exact opposite, to doing an endocrine workup on the rats. We basically treated them as if they were endocrine patients, and we worked up that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis to see whether there was a problem in the hypothalamus or the pituitary or the adrenals, exactly the way an endocrinologist would do if a patient came to you and you thought that they might have Addison's disease.
So these were the experimental group of the rats?
Well, we worked up both of them to figure out what the difference, to see the difference.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it turned out to be correct. We only needed to see 5 rats of each strain. And when we showed the data to the statistician, he said, you don't need statistics. This is just so obvious. Because the rats that developed arthritis had virtually no hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis response. There was no hypothalamic CRH, pituitary ACTH, or adrenal glucocorticoid response to that same stimulus, to strep cell walls. And the Fisher rats, the ones that ordinarily don't develop arthritis, had a hyperactive stress response, hormonal stress response. And then in other series of experiments, we did various permutations and combinations of blocking the glucocorticoid receptor, blocking that brain's hormonal stress response in the hyper-stress responsive rats and reconstituting it in the hypo-stress responsive rats. And we were able to then turn one strain, the ones that were usually resistant to inflammation, into again, rats that were so susceptible that they clearly developed massive evidence of inflammation. And vice versa, we were able to correct the problem in the blunted stress response rats and protect them from inflammation. So we were able to show that animals who ordinarily you couldn't tell the difference and then nothing happens to them if they're not exposed to these bits and pieces of strep cell walls. If they're kept in a sterile environment, nothing happens to them. But as soon as they're exposed to various bits and pieces of different kinds of bacteria, they develop this inflammatory arthritis that looks like human rheumatoid arthritis. And we were able to show that the brain's stress response plays a very important role in predisposing whether or not those animals were going to get arthritis or not. The upshot of it was, at the time, a lot of research was being done on different aspects of the brain-immune connection. But there was some skepticism, there's a lot of skepticism, in the scientific community, in the medical community, as to how relevant any of these brain-immune connections were to actual human disease. And on the other side of it, it's been known for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, in the popular culture that stress can make you sick. But there wasn't really clear-cut evidence of how to do that.
So let me just summarize. In doing this work for a rheumatoid arthritis model, what fell into your lap was essentially two strains of lab rats who had fundamental differences in the way that their hypothalamic pituitary axes worked in their responsiveness.
Right.
And this allowed you to contrast and compare
exactly
the HPA axis and its effect on the immune system.
Exactly.
And also that evolved into a great deal of other bits of research, which we'll come to in a moment. But I want to emphasize to people to walk through the HPA axis for our audience. And so stress is primarily, just like pain, it's felt initially, let's say, in the brain. And that creates a signal. And that signal
right.
is a bunch of neurotransmitters. And we won't get too elaborate on that. But ultimately, what happens in stress is that you release CRH.
Right. As you alluded to, stress has many parts. I think when people think about stress, mostly they think about the bad thing that happens to them. Right. Stock market's falling, the death of a loved one, whatever the stressful event is. But that's only one very small part of it. As soon as you're exposed to a stressful event, you then have a stress response. What we're talking about now is the physiological stress response. And there are many parts to that. Without going into great detail, one is this brain's hormonal stress response, where your hypothalamus starts pumping out its hormone, CRH, and the pituitary, its hormone, and ultimately the adrenal glands, its hormone, cortisol. Most people will recognize that as cortisone, which they have probably used for a poison ivy rash or a skin rash or sinusitis or asthma or whatever. And you will know that that's one of the most potent anti-inflammatory drugs that our body makes.
Also an immune suppressant.
An immune suppressant, exactly. And in fact, the Nobel Prize was given to Kendall and Hench in 1950 for discovering the effectiveness of cortisone in treating rheumatoid arthritis. So from that moment on, from 1950 on, it was thought that cortisone was a drug. Nobody thought of it as the body's own way of regulating the immune system through this anti-inflammatory effect. So that's one thing that happens when you're stressed. Another thing that happens is your adrenaline-like nerves and your adrenaline from the adrenal gland starts pumping out. So all these stress hormones and nerve chemicals together make you feel the way you feel when you're stressed. You feel anxious, you feel sweaty, your heart is beating fast, you want to run to the bathroom. All of these things are what we recognize as our stress response. Something very important has to happen between the bad thing that happens to you and your physiological stress response, and that's perception. If you don't perceive that event as stressful, then you're not going to have much of a stress response, if any at all. And if that stress response goes on for too long, all those stress hormones and nerve chemicals are going to do damage to the cells in your body, including the cells of the immune system, which will make you less able to fight disease. Now, I want to make one point here about the stress response is the reason we all have a stress response, whether we're a fruit fly or a fish or a mouse, a cat, a rat, a human, we all have that physiological stress response that kicks in almost instantaneously when we are exposed to a stressful event. The reason we have that stress response is it is life-saving. We need it. If those Lewis rats, the rats that get arthritis that have a blunted stress response, they also, when they're in a novel environment, they run around and they explore and they couldn't care less about the newness of the environment, and sometimes they go to sleep. If they were living in the wild and they went to sleep in a new field when they arrived in the new field, they'd be eaten by the next cat that came along. So you need that stress response to keep you vigilant, to focus your attention, to give you the energy to fight or flee. That's what the stress response does for you. That's your stress response working for you to get you out of danger, to keep you focused on task, to enhance your performance at whatever task is at hand. And then what it should do is it should shut off as soon as you don't need it. The problem arises when it doesn't shut off and it keeps on going. That's when you get sick. That's when it tunes down the immune system too much, and you end up with illnesses that are related to a blunted inflammatory or immune response. You're more susceptible to viral infection, more frequent and severe viral infections. You have worse take rate to vaccine, prolonged wound healing. This is all work done by Janke Kohl-Glaser and Ron Glaser and Sheldon Cohn and Bruce Rabin. Did really the landmark work in these areas of the effects of chronic stress on illness.
Osteoporosis too, no?
Well, yeah, so osteoporosis, metabolic syndrome can all result from chronic exposure to increased glucocorticoids. There's also newer work that's very exciting by Susan Luckendorf and her colleagues showing that chronic stress and the release of adrenaline-like nerve chemicals is associated with speeding of tumor growth, particularly ovarian tumors. And the reason is because those adrenaline-like nerve chemicals trigger vascular growth factors that allow the tumor to be fed with more nutrients so that the tumor grows.
That's a really important point. So stress indirectly creates angiogenesis factors.
Yes.
That if there's a cancer in the body,
right,
will enable that cancer to grow more quickly. And
exactly.
Spread.
And that's a very important point is stress does not cause cancer. Stress does not cause arthritis. In all these diseases, there are many, many genes, mostly each with small effect, only about 35% contributing to the risk of getting these diseases. And you have to have those genes. You have to have been exposed to whatever it is that triggers that particular disease, whether it's a virus or bacteria, or we don't know what it is. But if you have such a tendency, if you have that predisposition and you have the illness, then stress through those nerve chemicals and hormones can exacerbate it, make it worse, speed it up, or make you develop it at a particular time when you are extremely stressed. So, and then there's another very interesting study by Alyssa Eppel, actually right in your neck of the woods at UCSF, who's done beautiful studies looking at telomere shortening.
Yes, that's really interesting work. Give us a little background on it, for those who haven't heard.
What telomeres are, they're the ends of chromosomes, and the way to think about them is the little plastic ends of shoelaces. You know that as your shoelace gets older, the little plastic ends fall off and then the shoelace frays and gets shortened. The same thing happens to your chromosomes. With age, those little telomeres at the end that should be capping the chromosome fray, get shorter, and the chromosome gets shorter. And you can actually measure this. And what Alyssa Eppel and her colleagues did is they measured telomere length in people who were chronically stressed and people who were not stressed. And they found that the telomere length in people who were chronically stressed could be somewhere in the range of 7 to 17 years shorter than their biological age. That's pretty amazing.
And we've seen that intuitively. We've seen people who seem to age because they were under an incredibly stressful situation. And it looks like they put on 10 years.
Well, I don't know if you saw, there was a recent article in one of the major newspapers showing pictures of the presidents.
Yes.
And you see at the start of their four-year term and at the end of their four-year term, and they've aged 10 years. Now, that's a pretty stressful job, but it's very, very clear that stress can speed aging. So there's a lot of negative effects of chronic stress on all aspects of your body. And to the extent that you can do things to minimize or reduce stress or cope with it, you can't do anything about the bad thing that happens to you. That's life. Bad things happen. But you can do things to help to reduce or minimize that exposure to stress.
There's one group in particular that is extremely vulnerable to stress, and I suppose it's natural enough. When you shoot an arrow, if you're 1 degree off at the time, that's a millimeter, but by the time the arrow reaches its target, you're 20 feet off. If you're 1 week old and you're subjected to a great deal of stress, that's going to have a much greater effect, perhaps even changing your DNA. And I wanted to ask you about the work that you've done with the rats and mothering, because I think that that is some of the most fascinating research that I've heard of in a long time.
That was a very interesting story. So we were studying these Lewis and Fisher rats. Lewis are the low-stress responsive that get arthritis, and the Fisher are the high-stress responsive that don't get arthritis. And we were doing genetic studies on them, and I had a veterinarian in the lab, Maria Gomez, who was doing the genetic studies and breeding the rats in order to do these. And she came to me one day and she said, you know, I noticed that the mothers of the two different strains behave very differently towards the pups when I'm trying to wean them. And she said, I'd like to go back and get a PhD and try to figure out if this observation is correct and if the difference in maternal behavior is contributing to their later stress responsiveness and perhaps inflammatory disease susceptibility. In fact, she did go back and get a PhD at American University with Tony Riley, who's a behavioral psychologist, and did find that there was a dramatic difference when measured in observed quantitative manner in the maternal behavior towards the pups of these two strains. So one simple way to measure this is you take the little pups and they kind of look like little peanuts at that age. They're, you know, just a few days after birth, and you put them around the edge of a new cage and you put the mom in the middle and you film it and you watch to see how long it takes for the mother rat to pick up all the little pups and put them in a corner and crouch and nurse. I mean, anybody who's had dogs with puppies and cats with kittens will know that that's what they do. Well, the low stress responsive, high arthritis susceptible moms, the Lewis rats, immediately pick up all the pups, put them in the corner, and within 3 minutes they're sitting there happily nursing the pups. Whereas the Fisher rats, the high stress responsive moms who don't get arthritis, ignore the pups. If you let them go, they'll ignore them for a full 15 minutes. You don't do it longer than that because that's not good for the pups, but they'll just completely ignore the pups. And when I first showed this movie to a scientific audience at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, somebody at the back of the audience said, quick, get the rat social worker. But it is so dramatic, just like their stress response difference is so dramatic. And what's been known for a couple of decades, actually also from research in California by Seymour Levine back in the 1970s, and then more recently research by Michael Meany in Montreal, Canada, is that if you separate a rat pup from its mother in the first 2 weeks of life for as little as 5 to 15 minutes a day, they will develop a permanent increase in the brain's stress response that lasts through adulthood.
A permanent increase.
Permanent increase. So in humans, there's probably some equivalent, but not 5 to 15 minutes a day in the first 2 weeks of life. When I give this lecture to audiences, I say, don't worry. You know, if you're a mom, you can go to the movies, you can go to work. The equivalent in humans is just not the same. The similar studies have been done in humans in children who have been adopted from extremes of poverty or war zones at the time of the fall of the Ceausescu regime in Romania and Serbia and so on, who've been adopted into American or European families before and after the age of 9 months. And if they've been adopted before the age of 9 months, they seem to do fine. There's no problem. after the age of 9 months, the longer they've been exposed to these extremes of deprivation, the more problems they have. So people shouldn't go away thinking, oh my goodness, I can't leave my child for 5 or 15 minutes a day. But what we concluded from these experiments and what we did with these rats is we cross-fostered them, which means we had the low-stress moms adopt the high-stress pups and vice versa. And we were able to move the adult stress response a little bit. It was attenuated, for example, in the high-stress pups raised by a low-stress mom, but not completely. So you couldn't overcome the load of your genes. So the set point of the adult stress response is determined by many factors, probably genetic factors, probably early environmental exposures, and then, of course, later exposures to various stressful events.
Right, whether or not a person has cognitive coping skills and other things. When you start thinking about the implications for humans, it crosses my mind that we might want to think about doing additional intervention for people who, by their medical history, had very high-stress infancies, preemies, people who had to have multiple procedures because of, let's say, a congenital esophageal atresia or something, so they were operated on, punched with needles. Maybe what we need to do is teach those individuals increased coping skills and neurocognitive skills so that they can not perceive events as quite as stressful and turn down their stress.
Well, I think those kinds of coping skills should be taught to everybody, frankly. I think it can do us all some good. I would say that in the first book, I focus a lot on these aspects of stress and the stress response and how stress can make you sick and what that tells you about how we can help to learn how to cope with that. In the second book, I take the other side of it, which is healing. What can we learn from understanding these connections about how to help heal and help maintain health? And you mentioned the preemie babies. So in the second book, I actually talk about touch. The way I approach it is I ask the question, based on a landmark study by Roger Ulrich. You started off by talking about hospitals, so I want to get back to that. Hospitals as very stressful places. And if we know that stress can make you sick and prolongs wound healing and so on, why not do everything we can do to make hospitals less stressful places? Well, Roger Ulrich did a landmark study that was published in 1984 in the journal Science, looking retrospectively at a group of patients who had all received cholecystectomies. They'd had gallbladder surgery. Back then, you stayed in hospital for probably a week to 10 days after gallbladder surgery. And he looked at patients where the only difference between them was the view out the window. Some patients had a view of a clump of trees, and other patients had a view of a brick wall. In every other way, the surgery, the drugs, the potential complications, age, sex, the physicians and nurses taking care of them, everything else was matched and the same. The only difference between these patients was whether they had a view of a beautiful grove of trees or a view of a brick wall. And the patients with the view of the trees left hospital on average a day sooner, needed less pain medication, and had less negative nurses' notes than the patients who had a view of a brick wall.
Pretty significant.
Pretty significant. And the fact that it was published in the journal Science tells you that it really was very well controlled and a rigorous study. And what Roger Ulrich did by publishing this work and doing this work is he launched a field that really has changed hospital design. It's called evidence-based design. You can actually measure people's responses to built space and health outcomes and physiological responses and help to design that space to optimize health and healing. And so the question I start the book, Healing Spaces, with is, what is it about that view out the window that helps you heal? Is it the light, the color? Is it what you see? Is it what you hear? Is it what you smell? Is it what you touch in your environment? Is it something else, like exercise, like meditation? Perhaps they're looking out the window and able to meditate when they look at the trees. So what is it? And through the book, I address each of these different aspects of how we perceive space and place around us and how that could potentially help us heal or not. So, for example, in hospitals, we associate hospitals with a sterile environment in every sense of the word. And I asked the question, since when did the word sterile, when applied to a hospital environment, become a negative term? Originally, hospitals were places where people went to die back in the 1800s because there was so much rampant infection until germ theory was understood and it was realized that the blankets and the curtains and the carpets and whatever were carrying germs. And so the hospital environment was stripped of all possible surfaces that could potentially carry germs. So you had tiles on the wall, shiny metal surfaces, glass, whatever it is that could be kept clean, easily kept clean. Well, what that did is that certainly reduced the infections that were rampant in hospitals, but at the same time, it increased the noise.
Yes.
These surfaces reflect noise. And there have been recent studies done measuring decibel levels in hospital intensive care units and critical care units. And just to tell you the range, the recommended level is 35 decibels. That's a quiet office space. You know on the radio what decibel levels are. Most hospital settings are at least 45 decibels and can go up to 95 decibels in an intensive care unit or emergency room when, for example, heavy equipment is being moved, like x-ray equipment. 95 decibels is a motorcycle starting up and firing a couple of feet away from you.
Wow.
And that is a very stressful situation. So one way, simple way to reduce hospital stress is to remove the noise. How do you do it? We are very fortunate that we're in an era and a place where there's huge advances in materials design, where you can create acoustic tiles or surfaces that absorb that sound that nevertheless are easily cleanable, that can be maintained in a sterile fashion. So we can use technology now. Once we recognize what these problems are, we can use technology to remove those stress-causing environmental factors in hospitals. Another thing I talk about in the chapter called Labyrinths and Mazes. Most people think of a labyrinth. I don't know if when you think of it, it's positive or negative, but there's the old Minoan myth of Crete and the labyrinth. But in fact, a labyrinth is very different from a maze. And in the chapter on labyrinths and mazes, I start off with a description of Harry Potter in the maze, and describe his feelings of anxiety when he's going through this maze. In a maze, you can't see where you're going. You have multiple choice points. You're always in a novel situation. These are triggers to the stress response. I don't know how many people have recalled walking into a large hospital complex and finding themselves anxious because they don't know where they're going. They have to get to a certain appointment quickly. There aren't signs. You're in a maze. You're already stressed because you're anxious about your disease, and you don't need this added stress of finding yourself in a maze. Whereas a labyrinth is something very different, and it is, again, starting in California at Grace Church in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The pastor at Grace Church went to Chartres outside of Paris to see the labyrinth from the Middle Ages that is really a pattern in stone on the floor. It's a beautiful, looks almost like a rose. And for those who haven't walked on a labyrinth, you walk in very slowly, you follow the path to the center, and then you follow the path out. And it's really a walking meditation. And in the chapter on labyrinths and mazes in Healing Spaces, I explore what is it about that experience that can help you heal. This is now being used in many healing centers around the country, in churches. The National Cathedral has one in Washington, D.C., but many hospitals have labyrinths that they roll out. These are copied, printed on a canvas, and they're rolled out usually one day a week or one day a month. And people have the opportunity to walk slowly around the labyrinth. Some are installed in gardens, and I've seen one in a hospital that was a permanent labyrinth. And it really gives a person a time to quietly walk and breathe slowly and reflect. And the combination of meditation and exercise is actually a very healing combination that downshifts your stress response, downshifts it from that adrenaline-driven, glucocorticoid, cortisol-driven stress response to a relaxation response where you're breathing deeply and your vagus nerve kicks in and it slows your heart rate and the heart rate variability increases. Your rhythm is more variable, which is a good thing. It unclenches the heart and helps to shift that stress response down so that your immune system is allowed to heal. Now, people haven't done specific studies on labyrinth walking, but there's a wealth of studies on moderate mild exercise and how beneficial that is, both for the brain's mood centers, for mood, and also for enhancing immune responses. There's certainly a wealth of information about meditation and that also shifting the brain into a more positive state and helping to enhance immune responses.
While we're on the topic of exercise, I wanted to ask for a little clarification there because I have a lot of patients who I say, well, what do you do for stress reduction? And they say, well, I go to the gym. I do 20 minutes of cardio and then I lift weights, you know, do powerlifting. And when they come out, they feel tired. And I'm thinking, I'm not so sure they're actually relaxed.
That's an excellent question. And Moni Fleschner at the University of Colorado at Boulder has done a lot of work on this, both in rats and in humans. She actually has rats on little treadmills. And she is
They have little tiny sport shorts with a sport on them?
Well, it's actually quite funny. She herself is a sports enthusiast and runs and bikes. So she noticed when she was in graduate school that, and I tell this story in the book, one of the things that I do in both of these books, and certainly in Healing Spaces, is I tell the stories of the scientists who made the discoveries. I want people to know that scientists are real people, and we are all driven by really very deep need to know that often comes out of our own personal experience. And Moni had noticed that when she was in graduate school, she was an exercise enthusiast, and she seemed to be more resilient and got fewer flus and colds, and also seemed to be able to cope with stressful events more easily than her more sedentary colleagues. And there had been an earlier paper that she was very impressed with showing something similar in high school age girls. So she set out to do this in her own research, and she did train rats on treadmills and put them on a regimen that very much mimics a very intense training program at a gym, where she would increase the angle of the treadmill by 5 degrees every 5 days or so once the rat stabilized at that level of activity and so on, and thinking that these rats would be more resilient and less susceptible to infection and have an attenuated stress response. Well, it was the exact opposite. She found that these rats were quite stressed out. So as usual in research, it's the finding that's the opposite from the one you expect that is the most interesting and that leads to the greatest discoveries. What Moni Fleschner did at that point is she said, well, maybe it was just too strong an exercise regime. Maybe the rats needed to have something a little less strenuous. Actually, what she did is she, instead of putting them on this very strict regimen of increasing the intensity of exercise every 5 days and so on, she just put a running wheel in the cage and let the rats run as often as they wanted. So they were just given the choice to run how much they wanted and how often they wanted, and they did run. And under those conditions of mild to moderate exercise, the stress response was not overactivated. And in fact, the immune response was enhanced. And this has been shown over and over again, not only by Moni Fleschner and her colleagues, but the military has done many studies on the immune response and the stress response under different exercise conditions, as you can imagine. Patty Doister at the Uniformed Services University in Washington and many others. And really what is very clear is that mild to moderate exercise buffers against stress, enhances the immune response, whereas extremes of exercise actually are stressors and can dampen the immune response through those mechanisms that we talked about. In fact, Dean Ornish and Alyssa Epple and colleagues at UCSF have recently published a very exciting paper where they looked at a lifestyle change and its effects on telomerase. Remember the telomere story? Well, there is an enzyme called telomerase which knits back those ends of chromosomes. And they looked at the effects of a mild to moderate exercise, walking 30 minutes a day, that's all, a meditation intervention, mindfulness meditation, and healthy diet. So that combination of lifestyle change in people who were chronically stressed after 3 months actually significantly increased that enzyme that knits back the ends of chromosomes. So yes, there are certainly things that you can do to buffer and cope with stress that will also enhance your body's healing mechanisms.
Let's go back to the environmental design aspect, because share of personal experience, I have two offices. My standard primary care office is a very nice standard primary care office. There's lots of phones ringing, there's lots of people coming up and going, Dr. Don, so Dr. Jones is on the phone. There's a child somewhere off in the background screaming, and that's just so lovely when you have a headache and you're in a dark room and there's a baby getting a vaccination next door. We've done as much as we can with the situation, but there are a lot of cultural blocks and barriers. And in distinction to that, I have my acupuncture and functional medicine office. I did my best, your book wasn't out yet, or I would have bought it, to be a healing space. And I feel it when I walk into that office. Phone is not going to ring. If someone wants me, there's a little chime or a little bell they can ring if they need me. They ring a bell. And it feels like I'm not going to get jangled. I'm not going to get startled. Mm-hmm. And my patients have shared with me as well. I'll come in and I'll say, I'm so sorry I'm running late. And they're like, oh, that's all right. It's just nice to sit.
Well, there you are. You have anecdotal evidence that it's beneficial. And there are many studies being done now in hospital and clinic settings such as the one you described to actually measure health outcomes and come up with a number that tells you that this is helpful. One of them, the most extensive, is called the Pebble Project, started by the Center for Health Design, also in California. California is leading in this, I have to say. So what they did is they began to measure health outcomes of various sorts, whether it be blood pressure or heart rate or medication dose or pain medication requirement or length of stay and satisfaction, nursing turnover, in units that were being newly designed, wings, new units in different hospitals. And they called it the Pebble Project, where there were approximately 30 hospitals involved in this study. And each unit was slightly different and measured slightly different health outcomes. But nonetheless, when you put it all together, you can get a sense of whether these kinds of changes in design can be beneficial. So noise reduction. One very important area is in Alzheimer's care units. So for example, one of the first things that happens with Alzheimer's patients is they lose memory of place and space around them. I actually have two chapters, one, Finding Your Way, which talks about the brain's ability to perceive space and navigating through space. And one of the things that this movement of evidence-based design has done is help to design units for Alzheimer's patients which allow them to maintain independence longer because they incorporate elements of design that help them navigate. Sight lines to the bathroom from the bed so they don't have to remember how to get to the bathroom. Large landmarks like large clocks and lampposts in something that looks like a main street, like Disneyland's Main Street, so that they can navigate towards these landmarks and so on. Getting back to the Pebble Project, what they did is they measured actual health outcomes, and the aggregate as a whole does show with numbers that these kinds of changes in design really do improve health outcomes, do improve patient satisfaction, nursing and healthcare staff satisfaction, reduce staff turnover, even improve the sleep quality of staff at home at night. If you have a happier staff, the patients are going to be taken care of better. The patients in these units are less stressed, have shorter hospital stays, have less need for pain medication, and so on. So this has launched really a very important area of healthcare design where we pay attention not only to keeping the environment sterile and clean, which is very important, but also to maintaining support for the emotions and the mind.
So we have visual cues as being important in cognitive disorders. And coming off of anesthesia, I dare say that would qualify, that anyone the first day in a post-op unit is mild Alzheimer's disease because of the residual drugs. But are there things like certain colors? I mean, there's been much done about color, I wonder. Right.
Again, so in the chapter on seeing and healing, that's the first chapter in the book, I explore that. What is it about looking at that view of trees that helps you heal? Is it the color? Is it the light? Is it the view? Is it the pattern, what you see out the view, that helps you heal? And I do explore all of the above. And certainly there's a lot of evidence that light itself, full spectrum sunlight, is beneficial for moods, especially in seasonal affective disorder, but also in major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder. And one could imagine that in people who don't have some underlying diagnosis of a depressive disorder, when you're in hospital, the light can only help improve your mood. Color is a little more complicated. You know, the green operating rooms, and for so long operating rooms were green. I tried to trace that back in the book. I found that the earliest paper that was published was sometime early in the 1900s, where somebody came up with the idea that the surgeons are looking at red all day, blood, and so they need to look at the opposite color, green, on the walls to rest their eyes. That was the reason that operating rooms were colored green. So there wasn't any real scientific reason for doing it. But there is a lot of anecdotal evidence, actually a lot of evidence in the marketing literature, where they look at the effects of color on people's moods. And I have a piece in the book on the color green. And is it possible that the color green really is the default mode for our brains and our vision? Because as a species, we grew up in green forests and, you know, we're used to seeing the color green. The gene for reds and orange and yellows, that only came online very late in evolution, actually at the same time as primates began eating fruit. And so it's thought that possibly yellows and reds are exciting because you recognize them out of the background of green and it triggers the desire pathway so that you go after that fruit. That's sort of an evolutionary biology approach. More likely is that our associations of mood with color are learned. They're probably cultural, they're conditioned, they're learned by associating. You can certainly train an individual to associate a particular color with a positive mood or with a negative mood.
Let's come back to light for a moment. I wanted to ask you about the move from incandescent lights to fluorescent, any implications as far as your research?
Oh, that's very interesting. So that kind of research is just being done. And one of the scientists that I describe in the book is a researcher named Julian Thayer, who measures heart rate variability. I mentioned earlier heart rate variability.
Let's explain heart rate variability. I use that in my practice, and I think it's a fascinating topic.
Well, most people, you think about the heart and the heart rate as the speed of the heart beats. So it can either be beating fast or beating slow. But in fact, there's also variability between beats. So the beats are not regular. There is different spacing between the beats. Just like when you're listening to a musical piece, there's different spacing between the notes. And the more variable that spacing, the healthier is the heart rhythm. One of the researchers I describe in the book, Ari Goldberger, who's at Harvard and studies heart rate variability and uses very complex mathematics to analyze these rhythms, he likes to show, when he's giving his lectures, he likes to show slides where he shows different rhythms of the heart, and one of them is very variable and the other is not variable at all. And he asks people to pick which is the healthier rhythm. And most of the time people pick the more regular rhythm as the more healthy. But then he shows a slide and said, well, here is the unhealthiest rhythm of the heart, and it's a straight line. And the straight line is completely without variability. So the closer you are to lack of health of the heart, death, a straight line, the less variable is going to be the rhythm of the heart. And it has something to do with breathing. The slow breathing, this comes back to the meditation, back to the interventions like Tai Chi and yoga and walking a labyrinth, which all encourage this slow breathing pattern. that allows the breathing and the heart rhythm to be yoked together. And the breathing and that vagus nerve drive slows the heart, but doesn't only slow it, makes it healthier. It allows it to pump more effectively when it is in that more variable rhythm. And what Ari Goldberger says is it really unclenches the heart. It unclenches the system. When you're stressed, the system is clenched and it's marching to a very regular tune. And when you're relaxed, it unclenches and it has this free-flowing variability that goes with your breathing.
I think about, and this is just a pure metaphor, but I think about when I'm skiing. And I ski on two skis, I might add, an important distinction. And if I am constantly shifting my balance, this is particularly true with cross-country skiing where you're innately less stable. If I'm going down a hill fast on cross-country skis, if I keep shifting my balance back and forth, I'll stay on those skis because I'll be able, if one of the skis starts to skid, I'll be able to react and compensate. If I stiffen up and try to stay even between the 2 feet, I usually will fall over as my speed picks up.
That's an excellent, excellent analogy. That is a really great analogy. I would agree with that.
That's what your heart is doing. It's able to manifest more of a movement in order to compensate for whatever's thrown at it. And I also want to talk about respiratory variability for a second, because you're in family practice. One of the things that used to freak me out when I started taking care of kids is when they take a deep breath, their heartbeat changes. And when they let it out, their heartbeat changes again. And that's probably the sign of an extremely healthy heart.
Yes, I would agree.
So getting back to Dr. Thayer.
Oh, yes. These studies are just beginning to be done, looking at heart rate variability in response to different wavelengths of light. Julian Thayer is a researcher whom I describe in the book, actually in relation to his studies of the effects of music on heart rate variability and the stress response. He himself is a professional jazz musician who started off at the Berklee College of Music and continues to record jazz professionally. He went into psychophysiology, got his PhD professionally, when he noticed that the people listening to the pieces that he composed had very different emotional responses to either a sad piece or a happy piece, and he wanted to be able to measure people's responses. So he got very early on into this field of heart rate variability and was one of the pioneers who helped not only to develop the method, but to develop the complex mathematical tools to analyze those rhythms of the heart. And he's now applying that also to light and to people exposed to different wavelengths of light. And there are certainly other researchers as well who are beginning to look at that to see, are there wavelengths of light that are activating or make you feel more peaceful and so on.
I always found subjectively that the fluorescent light, even though I often am not really consciously perceiving the flicker, seems to be annoyingly activating. Is there research
yes,
to back
yes.
that?
So there is research on that, comparing fluorescent light and incandescent light, and more so the wavelengths, and whether it's full spectrum or whether it's more blue or more red. And this work is being done also in emergency rooms and in intensive care units. When you think of it, in intensive care units, patients are exposed to light 24/7, which is not the normal.
Very bad.
So you need to have your circadian rhythm. And yet the nurses and doctors and healthcare professionals taking care of you need to see what they're doing. So the question is, how do you change the wavelength of light in these intensive care units so the healthcare professionals can do their job, but the patient can be in a more peaceful and quiet and less stressful setting?
We do a lot of colossal social experiments without thinking them through. Plastic water bottles with bisphenol A being an example, but I'm wondering if we aren't doing it again as we, with all of the good intentions in the world, switch from incandescent lights to the lower wattage, more energy-conserving fluorescent lights. Is there any reason to think that that might be a bad idea or too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell, but I'm glad that you raised this issue because one of the points that I drive home in the book, in the last chapters, is the interface between environment and green in the sense not just of the color green, but what is good for the environment is also good for our health. And in most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, what is good for the environment is good for our health. I have a chapter called Healing Cities, Healing World, designing cities in such a way to enhance walking is green. It's good for the environment. It's also good for our health. If we throw up barriers and prevent people from walking, we have this nationwide epidemic of obesity going on with urban sprawl and lack of sidewalks and so on. Whereas people who live in cities which are walkable, New York, for example, San Francisco, for example, have better health outcomes. They're on the average about 5 to 10 pounds less heavy. There's less obesity. And you could argue it's because people who like to walk move to such cities. But in fact, if you are in such an environment that encourages walking, you will walk more. And that's good for your health. And you can go through systematically and look at pretty much every intervention that we're doing to encourage greenness. And these things are good for your health. Looking at a beautiful green view, a green roof. There's a wonderful Japanese roof garden in downtown LA on the roof of a convention center attached to a hotel in Little Tokyo. And it's this wonderful, peaceful spot where you can go and meditate and just lose yourself for a few moments in the midst of a busy, busy day. And yet it's a green roof and it's protecting that convention center. It needs less energy requirement and it's a LEED certified area and so on. So you can systematically analyze these kinds of interventions in the environment that are good for the environment, good for the world, good for green, and turn out to be really good for your health.
Bringing it back to the home, do you discuss the home environment and strategies for making your home a more healing place in your book?
Well, not directly, although I think in the course of reading it, you'll come up with ways of understanding how you can do that. But in the last chapter, I do talk about healing gardens and my place of peace. And I tell the story of how I went through a very stressful period in my life when my mother was dying of breast cancer. And I myself developed arthritis. Here I was, an arthritis doc, studying the role of the brain's stress response in arthritis. And I go through a stressful period, and I developed inflammatory arthritis myself. And moved into a new house at the same time, as actually just about 3 weeks before my mother died. And my new neighbors, who were Greek, knocked on the door and saw me writing the proposal of what became my first book, The Balance Within, and asked me if I'm a writer. And at that point, I didn't really think of myself as a writer. And I said, I don't know, why? Why do you ask? And they said, oh, because we've always wanted a writer to stay at our cottage in Crete. And I said, I'm a writer.
I'm a writer.
I'm a writer. And I went with them to Crete, and it was only for about 10 days, but it really changed my life. I started on this path to healing by changing my lifestyle with swimming every day, walking, gentle walking. There was a temple to the Greek god of healing at the top of the town, Asclepius, and I would wander around these ruins and sit and meditate and look out at the sea and the beautiful bougainvillea and the blue sea and the white stucco buildings, and it was just the most peaceful experience. And then to be surrounded with friends and dozens of grandmothers in the village who, you know, fed me wonderful Mediterranean diet. And you know, I didn't heal instantaneously at that point, but it certainly was the turning point in my healing. And I realized that wonderful as Greece is, wonderful as these kinds of experiences are, you can actually do that in your own home. You can create places of healing and of peace where you can go every day for just a few moments just to relax, to breathe slowly, to meditate, to be quiet. Even in the midst of tumult and all kinds of stress going on, what I describe in this last chapter was my mother's garden. For my mother, it was her place of peace. And when she was dying and I was writing, actually it was a Scientific American article on stress and illness, she kept asking me, why aren't you putting something in there about belief? Why aren't you putting something in there about gardens and healing? And I had all these very clever answers that there's not enough knowledge or information or research to support the beneficial effects of these kinds of interventions. And I'm only going to focus on stress and illness, which I did in the article in the Scientific American. And then after that, after she died, I realized that, in fact, she was right. And in a way, both books are an answer to that debate that we were having. And you were right. Gardens are a place of peace. And they are wonderful. They are healing. And there are lots of things that you can do in your own home to help you heal. I actually also describe the Huntington Garden in Los Angeles, They have a new Chinese garden there, which is wonderful and designed according to feng shui methods. And when you analyze feng shui methods, you can see that it really does adhere to the neurobiology of stress reduction and enhancing that sense of peace.
Well, on that note, I can't think of a better way to pull together the science of the heart, the science of healing, and the wisdom that we all carry within ourselves. Dr. Sternberg, thank you so much for this interview, and I want to remind people that her two books, The Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being, and The Balance Within, are available, and I want to urge you to take a look at them.
Thank you so much. It's really been a great pleasure.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.